Chapter 37, verses 1 through 4 and 12 through 28. Jacob settled in the land where his father had lived as an alien, the land of Canaan. This is the story of the family of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was shepherding the flock with his brothers. He was a helper to the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to their father. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he had made him a long robe with sleeves. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem, and Israel said to Joseph, "Are you not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "Here I am." So he said to him, "Now go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron. He came to Shechem, and a man found him wandering in the fields. The man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I am seeking my brothers," he said. "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." The man said, "They have gone away, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from a distance, and before he came near to them, they conspired to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we shall say that a wild animal has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he delivered him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into his pit here in the wilderness, but lay no hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand and restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the long robe with sleeves that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty. There was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. Looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, with their camels carrying gum, balm, and resin, on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers agreed. When some Midianite traders passed by, they drew Joseph up, lifting him out of the pit, and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt.
Our second scripture reading this morning comes from Matthew, the Gospel according to Matthew, the 14th chapter. And it is verses 22 through 33. It is a continuation of last week's story. Jesus insisted that the disciples get into the boat and preceded them to the other side. Having sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray, remaining there alone as night fell. Meanwhile, the boat, already 1,000 yards from shore, was being tossed about in the waves, which had been raised by the fierce winds. And at about 3 a.m, Jesus came walking toward them on the lake. When the disciples saw Jesus walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said. And in their fear, they began to cry out. Jesus hastened to reassure them. "Don't worry, it's me. Don't be afraid." Peter spoke up and said, "If it's really you, tell me to come to you across the water." "Come," Jesus said. So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water towards Jesus. But when he saw how strong the wind was, he became frightened. He began to sink and cried out, "Save me." Jesus immediately stretched out his hand and caught Peter. "You have so little faith," Jesus said to him. "Why do you doubt?" Once they had climbed into the boat, the wind died down, and those who were in the boat showed great reverence, declaring to Jesus, "You are indeed God's chosen own." May we be blessed by the reading, hearing, and pondering of God's holy word. So this is a story that I want to say most of us have heard at least once, if not multiple times in our lifespans. We know the story. So this morning, I'd like to invite us to break it down just a little bit. And I want to start with the boat, not the water, not Peter's dramatic exit over the side, but the boat. The boat where the other 11 disciples are sitting, soaked, exhausted, both watching and feeling the wind have its way with them for hours in the dark. I think that we tend to rush past the boat to get to the good parts, right? We want to get to the part where somebody does something extraordinary. Nod, nod, wink, wink, Jesus does something miraculous. But the boat is where most of us have been once or twice or maybe a dozen times in our life. Battered, tossed about, far from land, rowing against the wind that will not let up. Those headwinds can be absolutely miserable to deal with. And Jesus has sent them out into this boat. If you didn't catch it at the very beginning of that pericope, verse 22, where we start, it says, where I read in the Egalitarian Bible and also in Eugene Peterson's The Message, he insisted that they get into the boat. The Living Bible says he told them to get in the boat. The NRSV, which is the Pew Bibles, says he made them get into the boat. And if you're a King James Version lover, that one actually says he constrained them to the boat. So it's not, hey, just get in the boat and go away and I'll meet up with you a little bit later. He is forcibly saying, I'm done, go, and puts them in the boat. He puts them in the boat, on the water, and then he goes up the mountain alone to pray. Like I said, this is a continuation of last week's reading. And last week, Jesus was actually on his way to pray and grieve by himself. He gets in the boat to go across the lake, the Sea of Galilee, and be by himself. He's grieving the death of John. And now, everybody last week had heard where he's going, so all the townsfolk go out there, and he gets there, and he has compassion. He preaches, he heals, he ends up feeding 5,000 plus people. And now he is exhausted. He's tired. He is worn out. He's battling his own headwinds, if we actually want to look that deep into it. Just wants to be alone. So he puts the disciples in the boat, dismisses all the people, and he goes off in his own solitude. If we're pulling the parts and pieces out, so we have the boat, we have Jesus going out by himself, and that he prays throughout the night. The gospel, according to Matthew, tells us that it was early in the morning, somewhere around 3 a.m. And again, depending on the version that you read, it's either 3 or 6 or someplace in there. He finally comes to them. If we do the math from approximately when he sends them out, they have been on the water for over 10 hours. How many of you want to be on a calm crystal lake for 10 hours? Now imagine that you are being bumped and bruised and thrown around and it's dark and it's windy and you're wet and you're exhausted. They're out there fighting the headwinds and there is no text from Jesus with an ETA of when and where he's going to arrive. Nothing but the sound of their own labored breathing, the groans from the labor of trying to row. If I was on the boat, probably some seasickness going on. And then there's always the crash and the weight of the water hitting the boat. 11 of the disciples never get out of the boat. I want you to remember that Andrew, James, and John are in that boat with them, and they're all fishermen. So they should not have the fear, but it doesn't say that they were helping an awful lot. It's left to our interpretation. All of them are gripping either the gunwales or the oars while Peter has his moment. And I want to say a word, though, in defense of those that stay in the boat. Because I think that sometimes we pastors preach this text in a way that shames the people for not stepping out of the boat. Saying in the boat is not lesser faith. Sometimes staying in the boat, gripping the oar or the gunnels, keeping the vessel upright and heading in the right direction for the sake of everyone else that is in that boat is exactly the faithfulness that God calls us to. Not everyone is called to walk on water. Some of us are called to keep on rowing. So please know that it is not lesser faith if you never step out of that boat. And then we proceed to the worst hours of the night, that early morning we hear about. But I think that we understand, so if we look at it contextually, those early mornings, when we are caught up in our own fear and anxieties, we can get up and turn on the bedside lamp. We can leave a nightlight on in the kitchen or the bathroom. Historically, these people had nothing but a candle. And if they are out on the water, I bet the lantern is no longer burning. It is always darkest before the dawn, both figuratively and literally. And they are in the dark. It is a deep well of darkness. And if you have ever sat up all night with a diagnosis or a phone that you wish would ring because the child is not yet home, you know something about that stretch of hours. It's not usually the storm that breaks us. It's the length of waiting inside of that storm. So we've set the whole stage and the whole scene, and now all of a sudden Jesus comes walking out into the very chaos that's been throwing the boat around. They don't recognize, they being the disciples, they don't recognize the grace when it arrives looking like a ghost. And that's worth sitting with too, because sometimes we are most afraid of the thing that is actually coming to save us just because it is not in the shape, way, form, feeling that we think is going to come for help. Sometimes it comes in the least expected places. And that can be scary. And then finally, there's Peter and his words. Lord, if it is you, command me to come out and walk on the water to you. I used to hear this story about faith versus doubt. If you have enough faith and not enough doubt, this is what's going to happen. Peter starts out strong. He gets scared. He sinks. He gets rescued. Moral of the story, keep your eyes on Jesus. The reading isn't wrong, but it's thin. It doesn't hold a lot. It skips the part that I think is the actual center of the gravity of this text. Peter does not learn anything about faith while staying safely in the boat. He learns his faith in being swamped in the waves and a nose full of water. Peter gets out. He takes a step or two, at least for a few steps on the water that should not hold any human body up. And then he notices the wind. It's not a new wind. It's the same wind he's been fighting all night long. And now all of a sudden he notices it again. He's been walking on top of the exact conditions that have terrified him and the other 11. In a moment, his attention shifts from the person in front of him to the size of the problem around him. He goes down. Now, with all of that said, I can tell you that I have seen people walk on water twice. Once I saw, once I participated in. And I'll share those stories with you. So I grew up in the Kennebec River Valley in Augusta, Maine, and we were blessed during the 60s and 70s, and actually the mills were there way before that, but they came into my knowledge during the early 70s as I was growing up. Just below the dam, there are two mills, one on the east side and one on the west. One is a cotton mill and one is a paper mill. The cotton mill is on the west side, the paper mill is on the east side. And you can imagine that during the 60s, the 50s and 60s, and into the early 70s, they're spewing all of their waste into the water. It's right there. They're on the riverbank. Now, this is brackish water, so it gets moved around a lot. So the tide comes in all the way to the dam, it's about 32 miles or so of brackish water that we get. So when the EPA was developed in the early 70s, they stopped spewing all of the wastewater into the rivers, and the river starts cleaning up. 1980, we have our first whatever week celebration because the water has finally been deemed safe enough to go out on. Up until this point in time, there's no fishing, there's no boating, there's definitely no swimming because the water is just so poisonous. And it's now clean enough that we can actually go on the water. So we make this huge celebration on it. And we have the whatever week race. And what it is from Augusta, Maine to Gardner, Maine, which is 7 miles downriver. Anything that floats is fair game for the race. The only caveat is that it cannot be motorized. First year, there is a gentleman out there, and I see that he is actually standing in the middle of the river. Now, the river is timed so that you head south on the outgoing tide, so you're not pushing against the tide. And very few people come back up the river, because by the time you get down there, the tide's turned. Actually, not quite, but anyways, I digress. And he's standing out there, and I thought he was on a raft, that he was going to pull his way down the river. This is an old logging river. It's got logs and all the kinds of stuff in it. And really what he's standing on are two pieces of styrofoam that are twice his height and probably about this wide, and they're rigged with Venetian blinds underneath them. As long as his feet keep moving, he stays upright. And he did 7 miles down the river, walking. He had ski poles that had little styrofoam on them too. Now he did all of this though with a canoe right beside him. So should he tip over, he can be rescued. The second story of walking on water was vacation Bible school. So while I was a Sunday school teacher at Second Christian Congregational Church in Kittery, we had a very vibrant vacation Bible school program, but it was multi-generational. We did it after, we provided supper and then went into the evening so that parents could come with their kids and the elders could come and do all of this. This story was part of the curriculum. And my friend, who's an engineer, said, wouldn't it be cool if we could figure out a way to make this happen? She's an engineer. She worked in the Navy. Did you know, and I will share with you, that you can dissolve enough cornstarch into water that you can walk on it, as long as your feet keep moving? So I had a 6-foot underbed storage bin, so it's not real deep, but it's 6 feet long, so you can take 2 or 3 good strides in it. But you mix enough cornstarch in it, and if your feet keep moving, you can walk on water. Now, if you stop halfway there, hopefully you've already rolled up your pant legs, because otherwise they're going to get really, really wet. 7-year-olds trust this a whole lot more than 75-year-olds trust this, and it holds all body shapes and sizes, all of it. You can do it. But if you don't keep moving, you will sink. Now, I share these stories because both instances have the same rule buried inside of them. They only work if you keep moving. You have to keep the pressure on. You have never falter, never look down, never stop to think about what's going on. Just go. The moment you hesitate, the moment fear slows your feet or turns your attention to the length of the river that you're going to walk down, the blinds will catch the water, or the cornstarch remembers that it's dissolved in water and it will let the water win, you end up either in a canoe or asking somebody for a really good absorbent towel to dry your feet. That's not the flaw in the process, though, the sinking, the whole design of it. It was never meant to hold you up by your own strength. It was only ever going to work if you keep moving and don't get distracted. Peter is not wearing skis. There is no cornstarch in the Sea of Galilee. But the shape of what happens to him is exactly that. He has been sustained by something outside of the water itself for as long as his eyes are fixed forward and swallowed the instant that he falters. The distance is what Peter goes under. The difference is what Peter goes under. There's no canoe with an extra seat and no towel at hand. When he stops focusing on Jesus, he falters. However, though there's no canoe and no towel, there is a hand. There's a hand already reaching, already belonging to the one he has been walking towards in the first place. Peter needed help. He needed it fast, and he needed it precisely because the thing holding him up was never his own steadiness. It is his faith in Jesus. That's not a story about a man who briefly mastered the water. It's a story about a man who found out the hard way exactly who he actually depended on the whole time. So here's something that I would want to ask you about today. And it's a question that keeps coming up in this text if we really listen and really pay attention to it. It's the deepest things we know are rarely things we learn in calm water. So I want you to take a couple of seconds here, and you don't need to say it out loud. It is not a written test by any stretch of the word. But think about your own existence and time walking this earth so far. Not in the abstract, but in the specifics. What is the lesson that has shaped you into who you are? Not the lesson that you put on the resume, not the answer that you give when you're asked that wonderful question in every interview, tell us about the time that you had to work with the hard employee, not having the right equipment, whatever the problem may be, those questions that we get in interviews. What is the lesson that lives in your body? The one that changed the way you walked into a room, the way your shoulders sit, the way you brace or don't brace when the phone rings late at night, the way you know in here, not the way you think, but the way you know, down in your feet and in the most inner part of your body, what you're going to do the next time the ground shakes. The second part of that question is, did you learn that while you were in calm waters? I bet you didn't, for the most part. Most of us can point to the lesson and to the storm that taught us in the same breath, because they come together. The illness that taught you that your body could survive. The loss that taught you love does not require certainty to be real. The year everything fell apart that taught you who actually shows up for you. The failure that taught you your worth was never up for a vote in the first place. We don't get to choose those classrooms. I wish we did. We don't, because I would have avoided those classes in a heartbeat. We get thrown into them the way Peter got tossed out into the lake. Not by cruelty, but sometimes mysteriously, by the same hand that sent the boat out in the first place. Now, this is another place that I need to speak a very deep clarification. This is not a defense of suffering. Just like before, it's not a shame to stay in the boat. This is not in defense of suffering, that we have to go through these hard things. God is not, will not ever manufacture a storm so that we will learn character. That adage that God doesn't put anything more on your plate than what you can handle, it's bad theology, and it's cruel. It's cruel to say that to anyone who is in crisis. But the text doesn't claim that the storm was good or bad. It claims that in the storm, Jesus came, that in the water, not despite it, Peter found out something true about who was holding him that he could never have found out while in the boat. Because if we remember our Bible lessons, they've already had that lesson. They've already all been in a boat and tossed about by the sea, and Jesus is sound asleep. That's chapter 4 or 8, one of those back there. And they're being tossed about, and they can't take it anymore, and they wake up Jesus and say, "Will you save us, please?" And he says, "Peace. Shh. Be quiet." And the storm calms down. And here we are in the same story again because they haven't quite learned their lesson yet. Right. This story, being in this story, being out of the boat matters. Jesus doesn't wait for Peter to make it all the way across before reaching to him. Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. Not after a lecture, not after Peter proves himself, certainly not after "I told you so." The rescue is instant and it happens in the sinking. Not after it, not even with 5 feet over his head of water. Whatever lesson lives in your body, whatever storm wrote it into you, I want you to hear that the hand was already reaching for you before you even called out. That's not something you can know sitting comfortably in a boat somewhere on a quiet shore. You have to have gone under a little to know how fast that hand moves. And as we move from an individual perspective, I want to go into a collective perspective, because I think it's also true for churches as well. Congregations live as bodies as well. There are shared memories, a shared set of instincts, things that we just don't do, or we've always done them this way, that nobody remembers ever deciding on, because they weren't decided. They were survived. Every church that I have ever loved has some piece of its character that was forged in a hard season. A split, a scandal, a building that burned, a pastor who left wounds, a year when the doors might have closed for good. And you can usually tell if you pay attention that A, those stories are not singular. There's probably every church has suffered at least 2, if not 3 of those altogether. But with our churches, parts of our congregational personalities are written in fair weather, and which one of our personality traits were written in the storm. Because the storm-written parts tend to run deeper. They're parts nobody has to explain twice. Individually and collectively, we know the storms. So here is my invitation for you this week. And I mean it as a true spiritual practice. I've talked about these a few times before. Sometimes this week, sometime during the week, maybe while you're attending to the laundry or washing the dishes, maybe while you're mowing the lawn, somewhere where your hands are busy and your guard is down, ask yourself honestly, what is the lesson that lives within me? Where did I learn it? Was I in the boat, in the wind, in the dark? Was I already in the water? And then asked, who reached for me? Because I suspect, if you are honest, you will find out what Peter found out, that the wind is real, that the fear is real, that going under is real, and that none of it is a whole story. The whole story includes a hand immediately reaching. We don't get to skip the water to have that knowledge, but we're not going to walk through it alone either. Thanks be to God. Amen.